When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi.
Hello, welcome to Knock Knock High with the Glockenfleckens. I'm Dr. Glockenflecken, also known as Will Flannery.
I'm Lady Glockenflecken, also known as Kristen Flannery.
Still haven't officially changed my name yet. I go back and forth. Sometimes I say Will Flannery and then also known as Glockenflecken.
I know, I always have to stay on my
toes,
pay attention to which way.
What's more truthful?
Oh, gosh.
I don't know.
I don't know. Well, it depends on who you're talking about also. Like, to me, you're just always going to be Will. But
that's true.
You know, other people know you differently.
We have a very exciting show.
We do.
Very exciting. We have Dr. Vivek Murthy.
That's right. The U.S. Surgeon General.
U.S. Surgeon General.
Yes.
And he's not a surgeon. But that's
correct.
It's not a literal thing. It's just like he's like the most important.
He's like top doctor guy.
Top doctor person. Absolutely. And he has been just talking about a lot of really important issues, obviously. But one of those things that he's been talking about recently is the loneliness.
Yes, epidemic of loneliness.
Epidemic of loneliness. He recently did a college tour talking to young people about the importance of connection. And I really do think, like, you feel it. You feel just with news stories, things you see on social media, it's just like we're just not as connected. The pandemic obviously plays a role in this, but people seem at each other's throats a lot.
Yeah, just this greater sense of isolation, I think, might contribute to some of the division that we have in the country because we're not connecting with each other. We're just fighting each other.
So I like the message. I think it's an important one. So we talked to him a lot about that.
And it has a huge effect on people's physical health, mental health.
Yeah,
you know, it has a lot of relevance for people in the healthcare field.
And we also kind of soft launched my public service campaign.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk more about that. I don't know that I sign on to that.
Hey, we'll see. We'll see what I run for. I don't know.
Might
House
have
of Representatives,
to veto.
President.
I mean, being on social media is one thing, but.
Would you like to be First Lady of Glockenflecken?
Who said it was going to? Why wouldn't you be First Man?
I figured I'd be running for president.
Well.
Would you be? You think you'd be a better president than me?
Oh, absolutely. I would. Yes.
I think we need our audience
to
weigh in on this.
I am also smart enough to know that that would be a really miserable job. I'm not sure I would want to do it.
Everybody, I want you to tell us who would be a better president as far as you can tell in these small, you know, morsels of conversation that you hear between
us. Someone who sits in a room and puts on costumes and talks to themselves, or someone who runs a business and our life.
You're already slandering me. We haven't
it's
even
not
got
slandering. It's true.
We haven't even gotten to a debate yet, and you're already pulling out the big guns.
I'm just stating facts.
Okay. Well, anyway, regardless of who would be a better president, me. Let's. One thing we have to address though before we get to the interview is we had some technical difficulties.
We sure did. This made things quite interesting.
You guys, this may come as a surprise to you all, but sometimes government Wi-Fi is not all it's cracked up to be. So there were a few technical issues over there in Washington, D.C., I suppose. And so we had to re-record the second.
A portion,
like the last like 10 or 15 minutes of the interview, which we're forever grateful for Dr. Murthy's team for coming back.
Right.
On a different day and recording this last little
that
section
is really
for us.
Just unbelievable. How lucky are we that he would do that?
very nice. And so we really appreciate that. But so you'll notice, especially if you're watching on YouTube, in between the two recording sessions, we changed our
location.
Entire office.
Yes, we moved rooms.
I'm wearing different clothing.
I think my hair is straight now and it was curly and something. Everything's all different.
That's the reason. We tried to make it as seamless as possible. But, you know, things happen in podcasting. And right. We've learned some lessons from it. Punches. Now we always have backup recording going.
Well, we did have backups, but there was even an issue with the backup. I mean, it was horribly unlucky, but you know what? We, our producers are top notch.
They're so
and
good.
Dr. Morthy was very generous with his time. Absolutely. And so everything came together. And if you're listening on audio, you won't even notice a thing. But if you're watching on video, you will see us, you know, time travel. So enjoy.
So let's get to it. Here is Dr. Morthy. Today's episode is brought to you by the Nuance Dragon Ambient Experience, or DAX for short. This AI-powered ambient technology helps physicians be more efficient and reduce clinical documentation burden. To learn more about how DAX Copilot can help reduce burnout and restore the joy of practicing medicine, stick around after the episode or visit nuance.com/discoverDAX. That's nuance.com/discoverDAX. Dr. Morthy, thank you so much for joining us. It's really a pleasure to get to speak with us. With you. It's a pleasure.
Well, it is to get a to speak, to with, speak you. With you too.
We are so happy to have you.
Thank you. And please call me Vivek, by the way. I'm informal.
Vivek. Okay. Yeah. The first thing I wanted to ask you, and this may seem like a silly question, but do you like being Surgeon General? Is that okay for me to ask?
Yeah.
Do you enjoy this job?
I do enjoy it. Yeah, I do. It's not a job I ever thought I would have, to be honest with you, but I really do enjoy it. And at least something happens at least once a day that makes me feel incredibly grateful to have the chance to serve in this post. So yeah, no, I really do like it.
Well, I was going to ask you because, you know, when we go into med school, like I had no idea what I wanted to do for my career. You know, I had no idea ophthalmology was even existed as a specialty when I started med school.
And I can vouch for that. That's true. I was there and I saw.
Exactly.
Okay. So you knew each other when you were going through med school, Will.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We met in college.
That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
She's stuck by through all of it, through medical training, among other things as well. But yeah.
So Kristen, was the humor there in college or did it evolve thereafter?
Yeah, he did actually all the way back to high school is when started stand-up comedy. But yeah, I got to see some of his early stand-up shows while we were in college. And
it's much better now.
It's come a long way. No, it was good then too, but definitely a different flavor back then.
I love it. This is great.
So when did you get set on the path to this position? I'm curious, like how does that happen exactly?
Well, it didn't happen by design. You know, I'll tell you that when I was asked to serve or asked if I was interested in this position, it was at a time where I actually wasn't even thinking of working in government, much less, you know, serving in this specific position. And I was actually at the time I was practicing medicine. I was teaching at Students in Residence, and I was on the side working on a couple of other things on a technology venture to try to accelerate collaboration and research. And I was doing some advocacy work to try to extend sort of, you know, insurance coverage to more people. You know, those are the kind of things I was doing on the outside. But what happened actually to me, interestingly, is I was coming off a red-eye flight one day from LA back to Boston, where I lived. And I was about to go home to go to sleep, but I realized I had left my dry cleaning at the dry cleaners for like a week. I was like, I should probably go make sure it's still there. So I went and ran, picked it all up. My hands are full. And right when I'm like walking to my car with my hands full, my phone rings. And it's a 202 area code number. And I didn't recognize the specific number, but I knew it was Washington, D.C. But I just kept walking. I was like, I can't take this right now. Kept ringing. And finally, I just picked up the phone. And that ended up being a call from the White House asking me if I'd be interested in serving as Surgeon General. So I'll tell you that despite not being interested in a role in government, and the truth is I had actually been approached about 6 months before then about, you know, about whether I had an interest in serving in the administration. And I had actually declined at that time saying, you know, I can refer other people in. There are people I think are much more talented than I could like serve in policy positions, et cetera. But I didn't think that there was really a place for me. But there's something very unusual about this role in government, which is that it's one of the few roles in the administration which is truly independent, which means that your job is driven and shaped not by sort of politics or party, but by science and the public interest. That's supposed to be what shapes what you do, what you say, what you prioritize. And you also, as Surgeon General, you do establish your own agenda based on what is in the interests of the public. And that's why I've been blessed to be able to choose issues like mental health that I think are really important that need to be focused on. And so I've really appreciated the opportunity to be science-driven, to be independent at a time where, gosh, we've got so many health crises going on in this country.
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize that. I assumed that the issues, the topics that you talk about and that are focus of your job, it was part of the administration. I didn't know that it was kind of as independent as it is. So when you started the job, mm-hmm. how did you decide what topics you wanted to really focus in on? Obviously, things going on in the world, right? But mm-hmm. Were there things that are very, very special to you?
Yeah,
and
like if
your
Will
life.
Were Surgeon General, we'd all be mm-hmm. talking about nothing but eyeballs. So
that's
so.
Right. Yeah, I'd be on a rant against Visine. I'd be
that's
outlawing
right.
Visine, which you probably don't even have that like ability to outlaw things. But you know what I'm saying.
You'd be trying,
but that wouldn't stop you, Will. I understand. Yeah.
Absolutely not. Yeah, that's right.
Well, and I'll tell you that. Well, I had a list of things that I wanted to work on that I talked about during my Senate confirmation hearing the first time, I did this job. And, while I had that list going in, it was driven in part by what I was seeing as a doctor, but also based on my read of public health data, trying to understand what's causing the greatest amount of death, disease, and disability, like in our country, and how can I help, to address those or contribute to that. But then when I became Surgeon General, I decided, and I had a long time to think about what I wanted to do because my confirmation process the first time took a very long time. But when I began the job, finally, I realized that, what I really want to do is I just want to go and listen to people and travel around the country and ask people, like, what are they going through? What do they think is important? How could I be helpful? And that ended up being a really pivotal experience for me, that listening tour, because I heard about some things that you might expect. Like I heard a lot about the opioid epidemic and the addiction crisis more broadly, but the volume is even higher than what I may have imagined. But I also heard about things like e-cigarettes, for example, from educators and parents who, back in 2015, were really concerned that more and more kids were vaping, but there were no policies around it in schools and in communities because people didn't know how to think about it. But then I heard about issues I didn't expect to hear about at all, which are issues like loneliness and isolation. And this wasn't just coming from older adults who maybe worked at the, later years of their life and who had lost a lot of family members and were living alone. I was hearing about loneliness from college students who were on campuses surrounded by thousands of other students, yet they felt like nobody really knew them for who they were and they felt profoundly alone. So those conversations really helped shape what my agenda was. So in my first term, for example, back in 14, 15, 16, and early 17, I ended up focusing on e-cigarettes, on the opioid epidemic, on broader issues related to emotional health and well-being. And my time my second term as Surgeon General, I came in during the COVID pandemic. So I certainly focused a lot on COVID in the beginning. But from the beginning, even before I started, I was particularly concerned about the silent toll it was taking on our mental health and about how mental health had been a long struggle in our country for years with rising rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide. COVID was making it worse. But it wasn't certainly the instigator of it. And so I knew that I wanted to dig into that issue and into trying to help address some of the root causes of what was driving the mental health crisis.
Yeah, that's something that's very, I was going to say near and dear, but that's the wrong terminology. It's something we are deeply familiar with because we've had a lot of, kind of in a different way, but we've had a lot of major health crises as young adults. Will's had cancer twice and mm-hmm. a sudden cardiac arrest and I did CPR on him and all of that had a lot of really profound impacts on us, obviously, but it's very, especially as young adults, when you go into the hospital and you see all the brochures and, it's people three times your age and it's issues, it's talking about issues that older people have, but not younger people, and it's leaving out issues that younger adults might have. Like, what do we tell our children, for example? Like, it's all a very isolating and lonely experience, on top of all of the other things about our society that are creating a lot of loneliness. So this is definitely something that I'm really interested in. I'm so glad you're doing, because I feel like, physical health and mental health, at least within the healthcare system, they're often looked at separately, or at least historically they have been. But that distinction between them is really pretty arbitrary. I studied psychophysiology as an undergraduate and a graduate student. And so this is something that is like, I love it. You're speaking my language. And I've been on a soapbox about it forever. But can you talk a bit about, because our audience is largely healthcare workers. So can you talk a bit about, you know, what is medically relevant about social disconnection or loneliness? And do we know any biological mechanisms that are kind of underpinning all of this? Or is it just correlation, causation? What are we talking about here? And how is it relevant for a medical audience?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And look, I think for most people out there, most of our colleagues in the health field, they probably never really learned about loneliness or isolation in their training. I certainly didn't in medical school and or in residency. But I'll tell you that even going back to my third year of medical school, I can remember seeing patients and realizing that they were really lonely because they would literally tell me how lonely they were. And I remember just not knowing what to do about that. And, you know, I could show up as a human being and try to be kind and try to be empathic and listen as best I could. But in back of my head, I was thinking, is there something else I should be doing here? Is there, like, how concerned should I be? Like, is this a medical problem? Is this, like, should I call social work? I didn't know what to do as a medical student and as a resident. And, you know, even though I was seeing it really commonly, it was only when I started doing a listening tour as Surgeon General that I realized, wait, hold on, this is not just something that I'm seeing in my clinical experience. It's not just something that I've experienced in my own life, which I have many times as a child and later as an adult, the challenge of loneliness. I realized it was everywhere. So I started to dig into the science around it. I think 50 years ago, we thought about health as all physical. A couple of decades ago, there's more recognition that there's a second dimension of health, which is mental health. And now I think what we have got to recognize is that there's also a third dimension, which is social health. And our social health has a profound impact on our mental and physical health. And so it's a critical component we've got to pay attention to.
So you mentioned knowing that, you know, this problem has existed for quite a while, but the pandemic kind of put a spotlight on it in a lot of ways.
It accelerated so many issues. Yeah.
And so how did you go about, you know, wanting to tackle this problem? How do you navigate the big elephant in the room of the pandemic and fear and anxiety and that comes with that to develop a strategy to attack this problem and try to?
Yeah, it feels like such a huge issue. You know, it feels like it can get discouraging to think about how many things need to change. You know, we have a society that's built around really incentivizing work over people sometimes, and a healthcare system that, you know, is primarily focused on disease, not necessarily the people with the disease. It just feels like such a Herculean task to try to overhaul all of this. So what are some manageable things that people can do to not be discouraged and to actually take action towards making some progress on these fronts, especially healthcare workers?
Well, you're right that addressing loneliness and isolation is a big challenge because there are a lot of societal underpinnings to the current crisis. But the good news in my mind is that there are actually steps we can take in our day-to-day life that can help us start feeling more connected today. And we can build on those to then create greater connection in our workplace, in our schools, in our neighborhoods and communities. But in our own lives, for example, just simply taking 10 to 15 minutes a day to reach out to and connect with somebody you care about can make a profound difference in how connected you feel over time. Second, making sure that when you're connecting with them, that you're actually giving them your full attention, that you're putting devices away and just focusing on them. That really ups.
Did you hear that?
That's right.
This is a common
it's
struggle.
Like he's talking directly to me. I'm sweating over here.
Kristen did.
I'm
going
to say
the
Surgeon General told you to put your phone away next time I need to talk to you.
Well, look, and it's something, like, Kristen, I've got to remind myself of too, because from time to time I catch myself, you know, talking, you know, to a friend, but then somehow like my hand is reached into my pocket and I'm scrolling through like my inbox or looking at scores on ESPN or something. And, you know, these are the things that we do, but they really diminish the quality of our interaction with one another. And so just even giving people the benefit of your full attention can really deepen the experience of connection. And the third thing that I'd recommend, this is like a very small, simple thing, is actually pick up the phone when your friends call, right? Now, this seems like so basic, but a lot of times, like if we're busy, right? Or if we're you know, in the right space, whatever, we might just, I'll just call them back later. We silence the phone and then like we maybe put them on the list to call back when we have an hour of free time, right? Which sometimes takes weeks or months or never right. happens. I've certainly done that. But I've since realized in the recent years that even if I just pick up the phone to say, hey, it's great to hear from you, Kristen. Can I call you back? I'm about to step into this podcast interview. And then I hang up and it takes all of 10 seconds. Hearing your voice and you're hearing my voice, it really does make a difference. Like, we are so hardwired for a connection. We're such magnets for it that even a little bit of high quality connection can make a big difference in how we feel. And lastly, I'll just tell you this. Look, I'm just finishing this college campus tour that I've been doing called our We Are Made to Connect tour, where we've been visiting college campuses around the country to engage directly with young people on these issues of isolation and loneliness. And we actually introduced them to some of these simple techniques, but we launched in the fall on these campuses something we called our 5 for 5 challenge, which is where we asked college students to take 5 acts of connection, 1 per day over 5 days. And they could be really simple. Expressing gratitude to someone, extending support to someone, or asking for help. And we actually usually do the first day's challenge actually right there in the room with them. It just takes 60 seconds. We ask everyone to think of someone that they're grateful for. And what's interesting is I usually will ask people, raise your hand if you have someone in mind. Every hand goes up. Because everyone, regardless of how lonely or connected you feel, there's somebody in your life at some point who's done something for you that you feel grateful for. And then we actually ask them in that moment to actually pull out their phone and to compose an email or a text to that person and then to send it. And then we ask them finally to turn the flashlight on their phone after they've hit send and then to hold it up. And you see all of these rays of light go up, like in the room. And you start to realize that in 60 seconds, we can actually do a lot to actually help extend connection to other people. And they feel good and we feel good. This is how we start the process of building connection. And we can then extend it to our workplaces. I think about my residency training, for example. Like I trained in internal medicine. It wasn't an easy program. I would say we worked long hours pretty hard, just like most residency programs. But I'll tell you this, every day when I came to work, I felt like I was coming to work with friends. And that's because of the very intentional effort that was made to create the kind of culture where we got to know each other. We supported one another. We looked out for one another. That really does make a difference. Our relationships are natural buffers for stress. And at a time where people are dealing with so much stress in their lives, from work, from trauma, from other sources, we need those relationships more than ever. And we can start building them with these small, simple steps.
I'm glad you mentioned residency because it's seems like we're in a time period where it's very hard for healthcare workers to get that connection with each other, the time constraints that people are under with
staff shortages.
Staff shortages, but also just the healthcare system that we're operating under and the documentation requirements and prior authorizations. And so what would you tell, physicians, nurses who have these constraints, like how in healthcare in 2023, how do you navigate that? How do you still maintain that connection with people in the face of so many barriers?
Well, it's really important. I will say when I went through training, which was now, about 20 years ago, I would say that the number of barriers to connecting with one another was less. And so I really feel for folks who are going through training right now, because I do think that the number of things you have to do outside of direct patient care have multiplied. The number of prior authorizations you have to navigate, which frustrates me and I know many others to no end. Just the amount of non-patient care related work. And there often, I don't think, is enough of a priority placed on protecting time for trainees to actually engage with one another and get to know each other. That is really, really vital. But a couple of things I'd say to that. One is like to leaders of programs, residency program leaders, and hospital system leaders, it's really important that trainees not only hear directly from you about the importance of creating space to build social connection, but that you follow that up with actual space and time in the schedule for people to know one another. One of the things that my program used to do is on a regular basis, they would actually allow or facilitate a small group of us to come together and to actually talk through some of the challenges that we were encountering in the clinical setting, and to whether it was, a patient who had coded and we had lost, and we were still struggling with how to process that, or a patient that we had had a difficult encounter with. We were trying to figure out how to make sense of that. Mm-hmm. And so that those circles were ones where we not only processed, but we actually bonded with one another. And that was really vital. So, but that only happened because the program made it a priority and carved out time and space.
Right.
Now, there's a setting where somebody could look at that and say, hey, you could have been taking care of patients during that 1 hour that you're getting together. You could have been attending a Grand Rounds lecture. Look, why? There could have been other educational value here. But that's where I think we have chronically underestimated how powerful and important those bonds are that we build with one another. It's not a nice to have. It's really a necessary to have. And finally, just for individuals who are going through this, who may not have a program yet that has this kind of time and space, I would just remind you that if you are feeling kind of lonely and disconnected from folks in your training program, it is highly unlikely you are the only one who is going through this. I know it seems like to all the rest of the, you know, the world, like everyone's doing fine. They're posting happy pictures on social media. They're talking about like the great events and parties they went to and how great life is. But we now have good data that tells us that behind the scenes, under the surface, people really are struggling. In fact, often the majority of people with some sense of loneliness and isolation. If you can even start to reach out and talk about this with even one, residency classmate, you can help open up a conversation that could be powerful for both of you. And arguably a conversation that could happen amongst more of your classmates. And that itself could help build the kind of community that we so desperately need, especially when we're going through stressful experiences like training.
It's kind of a catch 22. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he was in training and I was there too, it's sort of counterintuitive because in order to create community, especially with medical training where you move around so much and all of your social connections are upended and you have to make new ones, you know, it feels like you're just alone, and it's counterintuitive that you should reach out to other people. If you want a community, it actually works best to try to create it, right? And then it's reciprocal. So you feel like you're waiting for people to reach out to you, but actually if you reach out to others, then very often they will reciprocate, and now you have something that's starting to build.
That is so well put, Kristen. You're exactly right, because... And this is actually a somewhat counterintuitive thing about social connection, is that it's when we may feel lonely and isolated ourselves, but when we actually look to help others and serve others, it actually helps us address our own loneliness, because we forge a bond with them, but we also remind ourselves that we have something of value to bring to the rest of the world. I remember coming in to pre-round one day during internship, and I had some sort of like sinusitis or upper respiratory infection. Something was like brewing, but you know, I didn't have a fever and I wore a mask hoping that I wouldn't infect anyone else. And I just came in because in those days, like everyone, wasn't always a whole lot of backup. You had to come to work. And I remember when I was pre-rounding, one of my co-interns saw me like kind of, you know, limping along, having a bit of a hard time. And I remember he pulled me aside for a moment just to say, hey man, are you okay? Like, do you need anything? Can I get you something from the cafeteria? Do you want me to pre-round on this patient for you? Do you want me to pull the vital signs for you so at least that'll make your note easier? Like, he was just asking me, like, how could he help me? He probably spent in total about 2 minutes with me, 2 to 3 minutes before I thanked him and said, don't worry, man, I got it. I'll be okay. I'll reach out to you if I need any help though. But 20 years later, I still remember that 2 to 3 minutes. Right? Mm-hmm. I felt so much closer to him. His name is Chadi in Dumoulin. He's a cardiologist at Johns Hopkins now. But what a powerful 2 minutes. And that is like one of the blessings that I try to remember, is that it's not about quantity of time that we spend with people. It's about the quality of time and our interactions. When I was in medical school, I remember a classmate of mine, her father got sick and he needed surgery. And we were all, you know, the four of us, I remember in our clinical group, we were all, you know, concerned about her. And we were also curious about what her dad's experience was like. And so we asked, I remember after he got through the surgery and everything, we asked her, hey, who was his favorite doctor in the hospital? We'd heard all the stereotypes, you know, of different doctors. And we want to know which one, like, who did he bond with? And to our surprise, she said, the surgeon was his favorite out of everyone who came to see him, like the internist, the cardiologist, everyone. Mm. And we're like, wow, we had heard that surgeons don't have a lot of time for patients, that they primarily want to be in the operating room. That was a stereotype, just to be clear. And she said, oh, no, he only saw my dad for 5 minutes. And it was at like 4:30 in the morning, like when he was bleary-eyed. So we were like, well, what gives then? Like, how did he bond? And she said, it's what he did in those 5 minutes that really mattered. He didn't stand at the doorway. He came in. He sat on the bed next to my father. He held his hand. He looked into his eyes. He actually listened to what my father said and responded to my father's questions as opposed to driving his own agenda. And at the end of that, my father felt like that 5 minutes was 30 minutes and it was what he looked forward to most every day. And that has stuck with me all these years later as just a reminder that those few minutes that we have, that we where we choose to look out for someone, ask someone how they're doing, express solidarity and support with someone, that can go a long way toward helping them not feel alone and helping us feel the same.
I relate so much to several of your stories there. When I was in residency, I was a chief. It was my final year of residency. I was diagnosed with testicular cancer. Mm-hmm. This is my second time with it. And I had that typical like physician mindset. I can't take a day off from work.
I told him,
Are you kidding me?
It was lunchtime. I was like, let's have someone cover for you. We need to go.
I'm not going to put that on somebody else. Mm-hmm. That was my thinking, right? And so I walk out of radiology having just received this diagnosis.
Like literally minutes before.
And I have like the on-call pager. And
oh my God,
the pager goes off. And a minute ago I was told I had to have surgery and all this other stuff. And it was a terrible trauma case in the emergency department. And I kind of broke down. I just started crying. I was like, I can't handle this. And fortunately, one of the fellows in the ophthalmology department was with me. And he's like walking by at that time and he saw me, knew something was wrong. And he just offered to take the pager from me. He said, go home. And I still think about that.
Mm.
And I will for a long time. I still tell people about that story. And it's you're so right. It doesn't take much time at all. And it can be a life-changing moment for people. And it also does start at the top. Right.
Yeah.
The program directors, the people who are in leadership positions, like they have to set that example because that's how trainees, that's how med students, they come up, they see those examples and they're going to take away a lot from that. I had a program director when I had that cancer diagnosis, he like offered to babysit our kids for us.
Oh, and he told him to go watch Mary Poppins with our 4-year-old because we needed a little bit of magic right then. I mean, it was the kindest thing. Hmm.
He set an example.
Yeah.
And that is what we need to just keep this idea, keep this this campaign going forward to try to improve this loneliness issue.
Yeah. Those are beautiful stories, by the way. I mean, just I had chills when you talked about your colleague saying, I'll hold a pager and your program director babysitting. I mean, I'll tell you one of the things that I am struck by is how powerful these moments of kindness are, yet how little we seem to value kindness as a source of strength, right? Like even I think about the terminology in training that we often use, like, I don't know if you guys use the term strong work, which people would say all the time, like,
oh yeah,
right?
Yeah, strong work.
Strong
of
work.
Course.
So I think about what we used to apply that to, right? Like when somebody like clinched a diagnosis and morning report, we'd say strong work. When somebody ran a good code, we'd say strong work. When somebody remembered the article, like in the literature that supported a particular, therapeutic decision, we'd say strong work, right? But we didn't often enough like recognize like the person who went in to the very difficult, complicated family situation and sat there and patiently listened to a patient and their family who were frustrated and got everyone to a point where they were at peace, and willing to move forward together and feel like they were on a team again. Like these moments, which we often dub as soft skills, of talking to occasion, being kind, being empathic, being understanding. There's nothing soft about those skills, right? They are incredibly valuable. They're central to our effectiveness, I think, as clinicians, but also to our effectiveness as colleagues. And so I would love to see a culture where we redefine strength, not solely as, how many papers I can publish and remember and how much information I can cram into my head, but also as my ability to reach down into my heart and bring forward the kind of kindness and empathy that we need to truly heal.
Yeah, I always say in my work, keynote speaking and writing, I always say, you know, remember, it's what I told him as a med student. And since then, you know, remember that before you are a physician or a nurse or a, you know, nurse practitioner, whatever you are, before you are that, before you are the surgeon general, you are a human.
Yes.
If you just think about it that way of not how would I interact with this person, you know, professional to patient, but how would I interact with this person just human to human? And typically, you know, that's all it takes. And it's usually, like we've been saying, a very short, easy thing to do, just asking, how are you, while making eye contact, for example. And I think that I know, at least in my experience, that goes a long way.
Yeah. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back with Dr. Morthy. Hey, everybody, exciting announcement. Do you want to tell them or should I?
Oh, you can.
I'm so excited. Due to popular demand, we're adding more live shows in California. Sunday, March 10th, we'll be at the San Jose Improv. And on Sunday, March 24th, we're returning to the Irvine Improv to share our amazing story called Wife and Death.
Yeah, we'll talk about that time you died.
And came back to life.
It'll be a tragicomic, multimedia, memoir, stage show extravaganza.
You got to check it out. To buy tickets, click the link in the description below, or you can go to glockenflecken.com/live. We'll see you there. Kristen, are you familiar with AI?
Yes, I have not been living under a rock.
There are AI tools for everything now.
That's right.
Well, guess what? We have Precision. This is the first ever EHR integrated infectious disease AI platform. This is super cool. For any specific patient, it automatically highlights better antibiotic regimens. It empowers clinicians to save more lives while reducing burnout. It just makes their life easier.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And also antibiotic stewardship.
Yeah.
Really cool things. To see a demo of this, go to precision.com/KKH. That's precision spelled with an X instead of an E. So precision.com/KKH. So we've talked a lot about the importance of human-to-human connection, Dr. Morthy, and obviously that's so important for healthcare workers to feel connected with each other, but also with patients. But I know a lot of people feel like it's just becoming increasingly more difficult to achieve that in the line of work as in healthcare. And so, what do you think that we can do from a policy standpoint to help make it easier for healthcare workers to have connection and maintain connection with patients? You know, we've talked about like prior auths and some of the stressors that we have, but well, where do we go from here?
Well, I think this is such an important question because the connection that clinicians have with their patients and with each other is a huge part of what fuels us in the work that we do. And cutting off that fuel is a recipe for burnout. And I do think that that is what we are seeing. I think there are a number of things that we have to do from a policy perspective to more broadly support clinician well-being. And some of this will feed into human connection as well. I think number one, like we have to start rigorously, transparently, and consistently measuring the well-being of clinicians in our health systems. You remember that old saying that many of us were taught in medical school, if you don't measure it, it doesn't matter. And you can't manage what you don't measure. That is true here as well. You know, if we truly believe this is important, the well-being of clinicians, we've got to measure it. We've got to be transparent about it. The second thing we've got to do is recognize that safety is a really important and critical part of any work environment. And right now, a lot of clinicians don't actually feel safe in their work environment. 80% of clinicians during the height of COVID actually said that they had been verbally or physically abused at work. That is an extraordinary number. We've got to have better provisions in our workplaces to not tolerate that kind of violence, or zero tolerance policy in general that helps protect clinicians from harm. Another thing that we've got to do, though, is we've got to recognize that a lot of the stressors that clinicians are experiencing, they can hit us all in different ways. Some can result in burnout. Some forms of stress, and I would say even trauma, can result in PTSD. We have a range of impacts on clinicians that we've got to account for and also make mental health care available to clinicians. Like clinicians are, yes, they may be busy. Yes, they may be caring for other people. It doesn't mean they don't need care themselves. And right now, what many clinicians, you know, tell us around the country is that a lot of times that care isn't even available. And even when it is, in theory, available, practically speaking, their cultural norms are against seeking that care. right? And you and the three of us may remember like early days of work hours restrictions when in theory, the work hour restrictions were on the books. In practice, the culture was not set up for people to actually follow those restrictions. And in fact, there's a lot of pressure not to work long hours, but just to put down 80 hours on your weekly log.
Yeah, that pressure's still there, I feel like. That's still, it's hard. It feels hard to change the priorities of our healthcare system sometimes. You know, like we still have a big focus on billing above all else, above working those long, long hours.
Well, and now we have private equity coming along too, and a lot of consolidation, and that contributes, I think, to making it more difficult for any sort of priority from the physician standpoint, you know?
So to your point, it does seem like it's not just going to happen by itself, right? It has to be a focused, like assertive effort to make these changes happen.
It has to be a focused effort from leadership in healthcare institutions, in policymaking bodies, which is why I think the presence of clinicians in those bodies is so vital and can't be replaced. It's also going to take a lot of advocacy from a grassroots perspective to ensure that healthcare systems and the policymakers know that they have to respond to these extraordinarily important needs. I mean, you were saying, Kristen, about private equity. This is like the thing about healthcare that I think is obvious, I think, to many people listening to this podcast, but doesn't seem reflected in how we manage healthcare, is that the value that clinicians deliver is about so much more than dollars and cents. I'm not saying the dollars and cents don't matter. We need to be able to have the resources to pay for gloves and gowns and procedures and equipment. I get that. But if that's only where we see the value, then we are missing just the human component of care. Like, how do you put a price tag on helping a patient feel more at peace with their diagnosis, with the relief a family member feels when they know they have a partner, like in their care, when they know that they're not alone? These are powerful elements of healing that aren't captured in a spreadsheet that someone may be doing if they're just trying to assess, you know, expense and revenue for an organization. And so I think having clinicians in leadership is so important to keep some of those priorities clear and straight. But last two things I'll mention to you, which I think are really important, is I do think it's essential that we change the quality of work that clinicians are experiencing. There's no clinician I've encountered who said, you know, I really dreamed of going into medicine as a child so that I could chart. That's really what it's about for me. Like, nobody says that, right? Like, we do these things because, we have to and we need to. We obviously need to keep good medical records. We want that to be available to people afterward. But the sheer imbalance in the system right now has gotten extreme. You know, when I issued a Surgeon General's advisory on health worker burnout in 2022, one of the things, points I noted was that was a study actually that showed for every 2 hours that clinicians were spending with administrative work, they're only spending 1 hour with direct patient care. That's not the right ratio here, right? And it leads clinicians to miss the quality of work the patient care brings, the fulfillment and sustenance and connection with patients that it brings. But patients are also wondering, why can't I spend more time with my clinician? And they're not always clear like where the attention is being diverted. So the quality of work matters. And that means addressing prior authorizations, which just sucks so much of the time and soul out of the practice of medicine. And a lot of times like, they're put in place to restrict certain procedures or medications. And I get that you want to make sure that things are being prescribed or utilized for the right reason. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I think we've gone well beyond that to a place where it has now become obstructive and in damaging to care, which is one of the reasons it was one of the most important changes that we called for in our advisory. And we're happy now to be working with CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is also now trying to push further along in advancing this effort to reduce prior authorizations. And we need the private sector, private payers to follow suit. But finally, I think the issue of how we build connection, it's influenced by all of these, by the way. If you don't have the energy to spend time and build connection with patients because your time and energy being sucked by administrative tasks that are duplicative, that are not contributing to patient care, that impacts your ability to connect with patients. But I think we can proactively do things that, like, whether it's helping to build and support peer support groups, like within the clinical system, whether it's creating opportunities for clinicians, especially in leadership levels, to talk openly about some of the challenges that they have had and are currently having, and to actually help and support one another in that process of overcoming those challenges. We need to build more fellowship, more community, and that's got to come from the top as well. You know, that can be something we all do as clinicians ourselves, reaching out more, being, you know, to others, supporting other clinicians who may be having a hard time, and just fundamentally recognizing that we're not the only ones who are struggling. A lot of clinicians are. But leadership in healthcare institutions have to also support this, have to make it a priority. And if they do, then I do think that we can build a strong, vibrant community of clinicians who can do better and more fulfilling and effective work, and who can build the kind of connections with each other and with patients that all of us truly want.
I think we also have some models within the government that maybe we can look to for, you know, lessons learned, whether it was here's some great things to do or here's, you know, the way not to do it. But the issue of physician mental health after the pandemic, during and after, it reminds me so much of PTSD in, you know, combat, you know, in soldiers and things like that. And they would come back, you know, decades ago, and we didn't even have the word for that, for what that was. Certainly no support, but, and there's definitely still a ways to go on that front, but we also have come a long way in understanding that condition and understanding that those people need support. And it's very similar in my mind for physicians in the pandemic. The things that everyone saw and had to do, and the ways that they were affected and their families were affected, and the amount of loss and tragedy and grief and all of these things, you know, I think that it has some commonalities with that we could look to maybe look for some solutions as well.
I think you're right, Kristen. I think there's a lot we can learn from how we manage the trauma and the pain that soldiers go through. There's actually a lot of overlap, I think, between the experience of soldiers and clinicians in the following way. You know, I think both individuals who often approach their job with a sense of mission, who often have to endure very difficult circumstances, especially if you're going into, you know, the theater of war, and who have to witness human suffering at levels that are unusual, and have to also experience pain themselves in the course of that work. All of that, and finally, when you experience all of that and don't always feel like people around you understand what you're going through and you can't talk openly about it, that is really a setup for suffering. And I think that suffering we are seeing not only among so many of our soldiers who are struggling with PTSD, but among many of our clinicians as well. And to your point, Kristen, if we were going to take a page out of a book and try to understand, well, what has worked, what has been working in terms of caring for soldiers with PTSD, you know, I think one of the things we've had to do is to try to address, number one, the stigma around mental health, which prevents people from talking openly about it. And I think that stigma exists in medicine too. You know, among, like, we don't talk as openly among our colleagues about our own struggles, whether it's with mental health specifically or more broadly, our struggles with burnout and with coping with what we're going through. But I think the other thing that was really important was to make sure that we get treatment and support available to people as quickly and as easily as possible, which means that you shouldn't have to make 15 calls and wait 3 months to get an appointment to see somebody who can help you with your mental health. There should be a no wrong door policy here. And a lot of feedback we were getting from nurses and doctors, you know, from around the country was that, you know, sure, I'd be happy to go see a clinician, but like, when am I supposed to do that? I'm working 16 hours a day. When am I supposed to take care of my mental health? Some of them said, if you had a place where I could go in the hospital, a private room where I could have a telemedicine appointment and talk to a counselor, you know, like right after my shift, right before my shift or on my break, I would do that. They said, that's not the problem. The problem is the logistics. So I think you're right that there are lessons that we can learn from other sectors. And this, I think, should be our moment as a country to recognize that our clinicians, the people we have tasked with helping to heal those who are struggling, that they too need healing. They too need support. They're human as well. And so we owe it to them, I think, to provide that immediate support, but also to build a better healthcare system that can let them do what they came here to do, which is to spend time with patients, to take care of them, and ultimately to build the kind of therapeutic relationships that I dreamed of when I was a young child thinking about going into medicine.
Yeah, I love that.
Yep.
Man. All right. Well, again, we want to thank you so much. We'll wrap things up here. But before we go, I do want to mention again the 5 for 5 connection challenge, and mention just where can people find information about this and bring it into their own lives.
Oh well, thanks for mentioning this. I've been so excited about this challenge. People can find more information about it at surgeongeneral.gov/challenge, and I'll tell you what it is. The 5 for 5 challenge is where I have been challenging college students and now the whole country to take one active connection each day for the next 5 days. And that could be asking someone for help. It could be expressing gratitude. It could be extending support to someone who's in need. But these simple actions, you could take it 30 seconds or a minute each day. But if you do them consistently over the course of 5 days, they will leave you feeling better. And I'll tell you that one of the things that we do when we're on college campuses is I often ask the students to take on the challenge, but to start it right there in the room while we're together. And they can do that. And in fact, for folks who are listening right now, you can do that right now as well. And by thinking about somebody in your life that you're grateful for, it could be anybody. It could be a friend who helped you out last week. It could be a family member who showed up for you at a time when you had lost faith in yourself and were just really doubting whether you had what it took. It could be somebody who helped you at a time where you fell short and you failed. And they helped you to see that, you know what, they still believed in you, that you still had what it took to move forward and that failure didn't define you. Whoever that person is, just think about that person for a moment. Just think about how you felt when they showed up for you. Think about how they lifted you up and how they believed in you. And then just take out your phone, and we're going to, you know, this is a way to use technology for good, and just compose a text message or an email to that person. And just send them a very quick note. It could be a single line. You could just say, hey, I'm thinking about you and was remembering how you showed up for me that time when I was really having a tough time. Thank you for being in my life. It could be literally that simple. And then just click send. This is what we do.
We are very grateful that you have spent some time with us today.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate that.
And then again,
that.
With our technical difficulties. So thank you for putting up with that.
And it's no problem. I will say, if I spent any more time talking to you, I might just have to run for office.
Oh boy!
I'm warning you now,
Kristen. And he's I'm feeling pretty patriotic right now. I don't know.
Oh my gosh! If Kristen gives you the green light,
have to give me your wife's phone number and have to have a chat about that.
Well, I'm just throwing it out there.
I think we could use more people like both of you in government and in office. Hey, so you're so inclined, I think it would be
maybe you're the one. I'll support you.
That's the real secret behind all of this. He's just the pretty face. I'm really the brains behind the operation.
That's right. All right. Well, thank you again so much, Dr. Morthy. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, so good to talk to you both as well. I'm so glad we did this.
Hey, Kristen.
What's up?
Name something that's like crusty and flaky.
A delicious croissant.
I appreciate your optimism.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I was thinking?
What?
Demodex blepharitis.
That is not as delicious.
Do you know what these little guys are?
What?
These are Demodex mites.
Yeah. That's not
They're cute
fun.
Though, aren't they?
Those ones
They're
are cute.
Cute. If you have red, itchy, irritated eyelids, you might be surprised to find out that it's a disease called Demodex blepharitis caused by these little guys, Demodex mites.
Do you ever see those in your clinic?
Yeah, occasionally. It's not uncommon.
Are they that cute when you see them under the microscope?
Not quite. All right, but you can make an appointment with your eye doctor and get an eyelid exam where they can help you know for sure if what you're suffering from is Demodex blepharitis. To find out more, go to eyelidcheck.com. Again, that's EYELIDcheck.com to get more information about Demodex blepharitis and these little guys, Demodex mites. Okay, let's take a look at a story that was sent in by a listener.
All right.
All right. We got one that's, I know I'm going to love it. I haven't read it yet, but I've seen the first line of it. Oh, ready?
Okay.
You'll understand pretty soon why I like it so much. Hit so me. This is from Lori, a fan. Lori.
Okay.
Says, hi, Doc. 3 years ago, my retina detached.
Oh, there it is.
There it is. I had the floaters, the flashes of light, and then the dreaded black curtain started. Mm. That's retinal detachment written all over it. I immediately see my ophthalmologist. He says, you have a giant tear in your retina. Macula is on. So what that means is the macula is the center of your retina.
Okay.
If the macula is off, it's detached.
Even worse.
It actually means you can wait a little longer to reattach it.
Oh.
If the macula is on, because if the macula is on, that means it's detaching and you don't want it to spread to the macula.
Okay.
So you got to go quickly to try to prevent the macula from detaching.
Okay.
So anyway, just think macula on is like more of an emergency for something that's already an emergency.
Okay.
All right.
And so that's what this person has.
Yes. So they said, the doctor said, giant tear, macula on, you need to have surgery today.
Today.
I need to send you to the only surgical group in Santa Barbara that works on retinas. They will be doing the surgery. I head over there and get the tests and a prescription for some pre and post surgical meds and am told to go to the hospital's eye surgery building at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, now that's odd, right? 5 o'clock surgery for an ophthalmologist? Well,
it's an emergency. You got to do it.
All right.
Fast forward several days later, my insurance says, we can't cover this claim because you didn't get a prior authorization. And further, the surgical group that you should have gone to are in Los Angeles. Yes, they expected me to drive to LA as I am actively going blind.
Yeah.
This all happened on the Friday before Memorial Day weekend. So you can imagine the traffic.
Yes.
How ridiculous is this? Very ridiculous.
So ridiculous.
And it's not, I've heard stories just like that. Yeah. Even like
there's no common sense built into this. Like
I heard a story of a firsthand from somebody in Colorado who they had to send a pediatric patient for a transplant to California, even though there was a team in Colorado that does it. But because of insurance and who they contract with, had to be sent
that is so
across the country.
Stupid. So, and how is that good for patient care? You know, making this transplant wait.
Laura, you're getting us riled up here.
I know. I always we're supposed to be comedy podcast.
Thank you for that story. And it's horrible. We hate it. But thank you for sending it. And you can send us your stories. knockknockhi@human-content.com. Thank you all for joining us. What a fantastic episode. Fantastic guest. Dr. Vivek Murthy.
That's right. And you know, who knew back in sixth grade when you were cutting up in your mom's class and she wrote you up and you had to get your disciplinary report signed by your dad? Who would have known that one day the U.S. Surgeon General would say, keep up the laughing. Keep doing what you're doing. So you could say, take that, Mom.
I mean, yeah. It really was. It's cool. I mean, because we collaborated once before on a video and about burnout. And that was a lot of fun.
Right.
And it was a challenge because we're trying to, you know, edit together a video and we're in two different places. But
So that
was a lot of fun. And so to hear that he wanted to, you know, come on our podcast, like, I was like, yes, let's do it.
Yeah, it was very cool. Very honored to have him as a guest and important work that he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I still think I could be a Surgeon General one day.
I don't want to do that.
I could be the first ophthalmologist
Internet
general.
Internet comedian ophthalmologist general.
The ophthalmologist Surgeon General. There you go. No?
Oh, I don't know why that just did a thumbs up, because I feel like a big thumbs down on that idea. Will it give us
you're
one?
You're not a fan? No.
No.
We're looking at our screen here, and it's doing funny things. Anyway, let us know. We want to know what you thought about this episode. Did you enjoy hearing about mental health issues? I think that's a really important thing that maybe we don't touch on as much as we should.
Yeah, I think there should be more on that in medical training and education, for sure. I mean, look, the brain's a part of your body. It's all your
it
body
sure is.
Doing things.
It's right there.
In your body. It's all healthcare.
I didn't get we didn't do a game with Dr. Murthy, but maybe next time.
There was too much good stuff happening. We wanted to hear about it.
That's right. I'm sure he's so busy too.
Yeah.
Like, what am I doing the rest of the day?
Yeah. Seriously, you're going to scratch your dog's stomach for a while, maybe have a nap on the couch, like maybe dress up in a costume later.
Oh, I will. We have to take some pictures for a live show, by the way.
Anyway,
lots of ways you can hit us up. You can reach out to us by email, knockknockhi@human-content.com. We're on all the social media platforms. Hang out with us and our Human Content Podcast family on Instagram and TikTok @HumanContentPods. Thank you to all the listeners leaving wonderful feedback and reviews. Don't you love those reviews?
It's
great. You read
them. It's nice to hear what people think. I always want to know what people think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If you subscribe and comment on your favorite podcasting app or on YouTube and give you a shout out, like today, we have Francis Bowman on YouTube said, this was the episode I needed this morning. Love Dr. J Max initiatives around music and medicine.
Yes, that was
a fun episode.
A good one. Yes.
Talk about high energy.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
God, nice. I wish I had that kind of energy. Keep sending us things, you guys. Keep sending us your stories and your jokes and your guest ideas. We love seeing those things. And you can do a little comment on YouTube or on TikTok. I mean, I see those.
Yeah.
And so if you have guest ideas,
Spotify,
let us know.
Podcast, anywhere really that you find us.
Full video episodes are every week on my YouTube channel at @DGlockenFlecken. We have a Patreon, lots of cool perks, bonus episodes, where we react to medical shows and movies, and hang out with other members of the Knock Knock High community. We are a growing community, the top 10 fastest growing communities in the United States.
Now I feel like that's perhaps the liberty you've taken.
We're getting applying for a township. Yep. Zoning laws, you know, We got to deal with those. We're a very quickly growing community.
Yeah.
Huge.
We've got some urban growth.
Some urban planning going on.
Development issues.
Absolutely. It's kind of a logistical nightmare, but we're getting there. We're dealing
with it. Please join us.
So early ad-free episode access, interactive Q&A live stream events, much more. Patreon.com/GlockenFlecken or go to GlockenFlecken.com. Speaking of Patreon community perks, new member shout out to Shelly S and C10 K.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Typo? Maybe not.
I'm just going to say it makes me think it's like Christine, but Christine. They shortened it.
Oh, Christine K, maybe.
C-T-I-N-E. K-A-Y.
Whoever you are,
please
we're
tell
so
us how to pronounce
happy
your name.
To have you. Thank you. Shout out to all the Jonathans, as always. Patrick Lysias, C. Sharon S., Omar Edward K., Stephen G., Jonathan F., Marion W., Mr. Grandaddy, Caitlin C., Brianna L., Leah D., K. L., Rachel L., Keith G., J.J. H., Derek N., Mary H., Susanna F., Muhammad K., Aviga Parker, Medical Meg, Bubbly Salt, and Pink Macho. A virtual head nod to you all. Patreon roulette random shout out to someone on the emergency medicine tier. We have Ryan. Thank you, Ryan, for being a patron. And thank you all for listening. We're your hosts, Will and Kristen Flannery, also known as the Glockham Fleckens. A special thanks to our guest today, U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy. Our executive producers are Will Flannery, Kristen Flannery, Aaron Courtney, Rob Goldman, and Shanti Brooke. Editor and engineer Jason Portizo. Our music is by Omer Binsby. To learn about our Knock Knock Highs program disclaimer and ethics policy, submission verification licensing terms, and HIPAA release terms, go to GlockenFlecken.com or reach out to us at knockknockhigh@human-content.com with any questions, concerns, or fun medical puns. Anything else?
Knock Knock High is a Human Content production.
That's right.
Goodbye.
Hey, Kristen.
What?
You know what people ask me about?
How tall you are.
No, sometimes. But no, they ask me about Jonathan.
Yes, I have heard people ask
everybody
you about that.
Everybody wants a Jonathan.
They
like,
do.
Is Jonathan real? Can I have your Jonathan? I'm like, no, you can't have my Jonathan. But you know what they can have?
What's that?
Dax Copilot.
Ah, yes. And that is basically a Jonathan.
It is like having a little Jonathan there. It's an AI powered ambient technology. It sits in the room with you and it helps create that clinical documentation.
Right.
While also allowing you to create a patient physician relationship that we all got into medicine to have. We all want that.
That's right. Nobody got in to start writing notes.
That's right. And it is right now, everyone feels overwhelmed and burdened by all this clinical documentation to where work-life balance, it just seems unattainable.
Right.
So to learn more about the Nuance Dragon Ambient Experience or DAX Copilot, visit nuance.com/discoverDAX. That's NUANCE.com/discoverDAX.